Reminder, based on the homonymous novel by Tom McCarthy, is the first feature film by video artist Omer Fast. He's interested in exploring the construction of narratives and how stories evolve when told and retold from different perspectives. A story is a story, he says, no matter the kind of stage it's shown on. Nonetheless, Reminder is a 5-year endeavor. Moving from the art world to feature filmmaking was a tough job, and a cinema is not the gallery space.
The differences are having to do, for example, with the way that the work is commissioned. So in the art world, the curators usually come to you quite spontaneously, very often just before, too late. And they bring a deadline and a certain amount of money and absolutely no input into the process. And in cinema, at least as far as I experienced it, the process is a lot more deliberative and a lot more collaborative, so you have a lot more involvement in terms of the production, having a say in how the story is shaped, how the production is conducted, and how the edit goes. Another big difference, of course, is the scale and the sense of time that each project involves, usually in the artwork. As I said, in the art world, the projects are very short sort of length. You normally work for about 6 months from the time I, you know, get the funding to the time that I have the exhibition. And Remainder took about 5 years from reading the book until the film was finished, or actually from pitching or talking about it to the production company to having the film released. It's very difficult for me to stay focused for that long. And I made 3 works as an artist in between. And so it's something that you have to fight very hard to preserve a sense of spontaneity and the accident and the mistake, the good ones, at least when you're working in cinema, because the pressures that come from outside can flatten the story in a way, and they can also flatten out the kind of kinks that we bring into it when we work more spontaneously and in a short term. And as artists, we are responsible for bringing a kink into things. You know, we're not responsible for executing something efficiently necessarily. But this is a pressure. This is something that contradicts the normal sort of production process, which is very much about timelines and you know, tablets and tables and Excel sheets and budgets. What the difference is in terms of consuming the works is perhaps significant, and works of art that are shown in art venues, you know, you have a situation where people walk in and out of a screening, and for me this is always a good thing. You know, it means that you have to kind of capture the audience. It's not the same ritual as what exists in cinema, where people pay for the ticket and the lights go down, they sit down and they prepare themselves to sit there for an hour and a half. You have a more chaotic situation, and I try to structure my stories in order to accommodate that. So the whole notion of causality and temporality is something that is very strongly taken into account in the stories that I, you know, create for art venues, and that often means that there is no beginning and end to it. The stories work in a loop, and you can come in at any one point and not miss something, you know, in quotes, not have to sit until, you know, the beginning comes again in order to understand the story. The story is not structured like that. And with cinema, of course, the temporal sense of experiencing the work and the temporal world that's in the work are much more in sync. It's literally more about reception, I think, than it is about anything that you do with the narrative. If you come in 7 minutes into Remainder, you're not going to understand the story. You will miss it completely. And of course, you can bend the piece and have it run continuously, but it's very long. It won't work so well in an art situation. I think the big bang that happens at the beginning and at the end of the film is too, it has too much symbolic and practical significance that we can kind of pretend like this is a piece of art. It's not. It wasn't made as an art piece. It was literally made as a movie to watch from beginning to end.
Much of Fast work delves into the psychology of contemporary trauma, finding its own way along the blurred and thin line between reality and non-reality, consciousness and unconsciousness. In order to do that, Fast manipulates the narrative conventions. He pushes the boundaries of film genres by looping and repeating, by scattering the stories with a constellation of signifying objects, markers, figures, archetypes and symbols that sometimes lead the audience towards different levels of meanings and sometimes just confound our expectations.
Sometimes I'm more conscious of what these objects or people or animals mean. I mean, in continuity, the camel is very intentionally a almost a mythical creature. We're talking about something that emerges from the forest and pulls people into the forest. And of course, it's in Germany. Of course, we know what happens in the forest in Germany. The couple follows the camel into the forest, and it literally is a messenger. It wants to show them something and to show us something. And so we follow the camel and the couple into the forest, and then we stand at the edge of a chasm, and we look down, and then we see, in a sense, a tableau, a kind of a visual sort of field where the bodies of almost all of the characters that we have seen or will see are lying in some kind of no man's land, you know, in between something which is hallucinatory and extremely psychological and very violent, and something which is very natural and very physical. And we also understand that through the couple's non-reaction, you know, they watch this scene of horror, but their face doesn't register it. They stay completely neutral and almost objective and clinical when they're looking at this. And it is their non-reaction, which to me is obviously the perverse. I mean, what would you do if you saw something like this in a forest? So when we see that people don't react to violence in a way that we expect, we begin to suspect them, you know, because if we don't, we have to suspect ourselves. Because if the way that they're reacting is normal, then the way that we're reacting is not normal. So we always blame the other, right? And we assume that these two characters, by not responding to violence, to the death or mutilation of these bodies, that they, in a sense, have a measure of culpability in it. And of course, the story reveals, in a way, their culpability. I mean, they are, you know, their fantasy life that they practice inside their home is in some ways directly connected to this violence that is happening. And where the violence is happening is another issue. And that is the kind of, I think, the kind of the socio-political sort of underbelly of continuity. It means that violence is happening. It is happening in a symbolic level in the kind of mimicry, in the kind of the facial and how we read the faces, but it is happening very much in a real sense somewhere else. And what the work is about shifting, you know, the violent into the symbolic and backwards. And this is happening through this kind of like game, this kind of erotic, violent game that the couple plays out in their home. And of course, they're vampires, they're consumers, you know, they're the ultimate sort of consumers of this kind of violence. They need to produce it in order to feel alive, in a sense. And the way that they don't respond to that scene tells us that their reaction, their synapses have been fried in a way. They don't anymore react in a normal way, so they need to up the dose or, you know, increase the fetish and the kink in order to have a sense that to have the kick, to have a sense of that life is livable.
In Reminder, we witnessed the same kind of consumption, the same kind of violence. Its protagonist is a persecutor, is willing to sacrifice everybody and everything to take pleasures in his vicious role play.
You haven't called me back in the last 6 weeks.
I've been busy.
Oh yeah? Doing what?
Moving to a new place.
Look, we need to talk. It's important. Come on, let's go for a walk.
I'm tired, Greg.
Gentrification's tough work.
He's a gentrifier. I mean, the story of Remainder is, for me, on some level, a kind of a fairy tale that involves a kind of a colonial structure and a gentrifying structure, and both of them are sort of intersecting in, you know, a specific borough in London, which is Brixton. And you don't have to know London, and you don't have to know the history of Brixton, and it's, frankly, it's interesting, but it's not sort of necessary in order to understand the story. What you know is that this person is kind of disconnected from his world. When you see him at the beginning, you see that he's this kind of, it's almost like a commercial, you know, I mean, at least that's what I was hoping to have it look like. You know, we see some young professional metropolitan metrosexual kind of guy with a nice suitcase, with a tight jacket, with a kind of slightly messy haircut. He's good looking, but he's under stress and he's going to catch an airplane and do something, you know, unclear, but definitely connected to screens and social media and business and startups and whatnot. And of course, what happens to him is the physical, the material falls down on him and pulls him out of that world, pulls him out of this commercial, and throws him into another one. And so he's shipwrecked. He's this kind of person who's stranded somewhere. And what he's given by the powers that be is a large compensation. And the money means nothing to him. He doesn't understand when he's given $8.5 million and the attorney tells him that, what is he obsessed over? He's obsessed over the half. Why is it, what is that annoying half doing there? Why isn't that 8 or 9 million or 10 million? You know, he doesn't get it. And the money is for him then something that he, through this process of alchemy, changes into something that he does get. And what he gets is this, increasingly, is this notion of repetition.
You have to make mistakes.
Sorry?
And go over the parts you've got wrong and play it again and again slowly until you get it right. In the day, you teach children. In the night, you compose. And when we're on, you never leave the flat.
What should I compose?
So he goes into an area. He goes into Brixton. He buys a building. He buys the apartment. He buys the people. He pays them to move out. The people who have to move out have a certain socioeconomic stature. They have a certain color. They have a certain ethnicity. The camera shows it. You know, they're very much in the background. But it was important for me to show that, you know, his fantasies, if he's an artist or if he's a gentrifier or if he's a director, have unfold in a real socioeconomic space, and that, you know, he brings otherness into these buildings. So he's not making lofts out of them. He's not making McMansions in this borough. What he's doing is something which we normally think is worthwhile. He's doing some kind of theater project. He's doing performance. He's doing a kind of a Dadaist Fluxus theater. But he's becoming increasingly addicted to it, so that the notion of repetition becomes much more important than any kind of ethical attachment to the people or the places or the relationships that he has. And that balance between his kind of aesthetic pleasure and the ethical dimension of what his work is what where the kind of, I think the development of this story, at least in the novel, is about, possibly in the film, although we have a much more cyclical story. In the film, he leaves the world of ethics and he gives himself over into a kind of a delirium of an aesthetic pursuit that results in catastrophe, of course.
Some of you have specific tasks to perform. Others just have to be somewhere without moving. Now, you may have noticed that in the building there are certain areas that have been left blank. That's just like the masks that some of you are wearing. You're not less important, you're just less specific.
Gentrification is an intensely emotive issue with almost endless potential for argument. That shouldn't be in the least bit surprising, than Hancock writes on The Guardian. It speaks to fundamental questions of home, identity and community. How does places define us and how we define them?
I was very much interested in the fact that he's moving into an area which is in like an inner city black area, and that he's not just moving people out, but he's also taking over. He's literally appropriating their style and elements of their culture. And so there is this kind of othering that he's doing, you know, and he's not like the typical white guy who just likes to listen to rap and, you know, say a couple of slang words, but then has a job in a field that is 99.9% white. He almost stumbles into, you know, his gentrifying sort of role and his role as an appropriator of urban culture and of black culture because of the increasing delirium that he's in. But the movie tries to be very light in how it deals with that. I mean, that's something that possibly you pick up on it. But I was, you know, thinking very much, of course, this was made before the Black Lives Matter and before the series of killings. But, you know, in London, there was a massive, massive situation involving the killing of a black guy by the police. And I didn't want to make this a topical issue in the book, but I wanted it to be something that is in the subtext of what he's doing. It's, again, we're talking about an underbelly. And for me, the underbelly is always, you know, the socio-political. It's always comes back. No matter how much we escape and fantasize about something, the kind of exactly that in that point where we fetishize something, where we follow, we let go and enter the fantastic realm, the symbolic realm, that's when the political comes and meets us unexpectedly, but inevitably, imminently. And so the movie tries to model that. The movie is a portrait, and all of my work, I think of it as portraits and as models for these situations, and I try to play around with the symbols so that it's not a lesson in civics. It's not a politically correct fairy tale. I mean, it's, you know, the black guy in this case has to die in order for the white guy to achieve his bliss in the end. That is the story.
And the story is also written by a choir of marginal characters, of scapegoats, sacrificed not only for the protagonist's bliss, but also on the altar of narration. And we are talking about the performers he hires, about Christopher, who gets mixed up in the thriller, and we are talking about Catherine, a woman the protagonist might have had a love affair with.
What I wanted to do is to create a portrait of what it's like for him to wake up after this traumatic event, after the accident, and to meet people who make certain claims about him and about a relationship that they've had with him in the past, and not knowing who these people are. But of course, we should also not know, because if we know more than he does, then it's something else, and I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in putting us and the protagonist in the same boat, and to not know exactly whether the person means well, whether the person's claims are indeed true. It was important for me to put that into question, not to provide the answers for that. So I'm not sure about, you know, who she is, but she has an important thing that he needs. And he's looking for. Her importance in the story is, in a sense, that she is a scapegoat, like you're saying, but she's also an enabler. You know, she returns in order to allow the character to enter his delirium. And his sexuality is also part of the problem, let's say, yeah? She makes certain claims about a relationship that they've had, and he remembers it, but of course what he remembers is something that he will enact with somebody a little bit later on and then possibly remember afterwards. That's the kind of crazy loopy temporality that Remainder is about. But in that process of recalling this kind of heterosexual relationship that he's had, he kind of awakens into another reality and another sexuality that is connected to his kind of his drive.
This is real, Nas, so everything has to be real.
Hello?
So, as much as he doesn't know, we don't know. But someone might have the great power to see, to know, to foresee. It's a super efficient fixer, Nas, the only one who seems to know how the story will go or might go. In a way, he is like Georges Perec maneuvering the forking path of Barthel Booth in Life, a User Manual. When everything starts to go wrong, Nas is the one who knows the way out.
12 scenarios, And each one of those scenarios has a subset of 104 permutations. But they all have one thing in common. They're all threatened by the same chief contingency.
Was it Greg?
No. The only way to stop any information from leaking would be to...
We had the ghost of Perek haunting us, just like we had somebody before mentioned Pierre Wieck with respect to the bank and his piece, The Third Memory, referencing Dog Day Afternoon. There is a lot of references that are haunting this project. And I think making a theater of the everyday is something which is so tied to, you know, modernist projects and the historical avant-garde and whatnot. And in that particular scene, I wasn't thinking of Perek. I was just hoping to put something on the wall that gives us a clue about the character Naz's involvement in logistics, how much of what he's doing is involving a kind of mapping and surveillance, and having that as a juxtaposition, I suppose, to the protagonist's character, who is unable to have an overview. He's never able to have that kind of master narrative, that kind of the god's eye view, the bird's eye view of things. He's very much stuck in the present, and he's obsessed with repeating it. And the camera work in Remainder tries to replicate that, and so we literally try to avoid telling the story with a lot of wide-angle shots and, you know, kind of master shots. The story exists in a very shallow depth of field using long lenses, and so that means that you have very little sense of what the background is and what the foreground is, and you're kind of stuck in a sort of a middle ground that keeps repeating itself, and that is a visual sort of reference, but has nothing to do with Perek.
This interview was recorded in Florence at Lo Schermo dell'Arte Film Festival on the occasion of the Italian premiere of both Reminder and Continuity. RadioPapesse.org